from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live conversation with Vermont author Emily Bernard, whose new collection is Black is the Body, Stories from My Grandmother's Time, My Mother's Time, and Mine, published by Knopf, which I can never say. So I'm going to share a little information now about Emily, and then we'll move into our conversation. And if she sounds familiar, it may be that you have heard her speaking around Vermont recently. She's on a big book tour, and she also just was in the station not too long ago speaking with Jin from the Upside VT. Emily was born and raised in Nashville, Tennessee. She holds a BA and a PhD in American Studies from Yale University. Her work has appeared in The American Scholar, The Boston Globe Magazine, Creative Nonfiction, Green Mountains Review, Oxford American, Plowshares, The New Republic, and TheAtlantic.com. Her essays have been reprinted in Best American Essays, Best African American Essays, and Best of Creative Nonfiction. Her first book, Remember Me to Harlem, The Letters of Langston Hughes and Carl Van Vechten, was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. She has received fellowships and grants from Yale University, Harvard University, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Vermont Arts Council, the Vermont Studio Center, and the McDowell Colony. A contributing editor at The American Scholar, Emily is the Julian Lindsay Green and Gold Professor of English at the University of Vermont. She lives in South Burlington with her husband John, twin daughters Isabella and Julia, Sammy the dog, a gentle giant, and William Tom, two very interesting cats. So I want to just mention Black is the Body, Stories from My Grandmother's Time, My Mother's Time, and Mine is published by Knopf, as I said. In the book, Emily sets out to discover, as she puts it, a new way of telling the truth as she has lived it. And what most interests her is looking at Blackness, at its borders where it meets whiteness, in fear and hope, in anguish and love. So, Emily, welcome to Write the Book.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. You've got a great radio voice. I'm going to make a little noise so I can see you. Okay. So I've so enjoyed reading your book. It's wonderful. And I'm looking forward to talking about it with you. I wanted to start out by talking about something that you write in the early part of the book, that you said each piece in this collection was born in a struggle to find a language that would capture, and this is your words, the totality of my experience as a woman, a Black American, a teacher, writer, mother, wife, and daughter. I loved the idea that one could bring to bear a totality of experience embraced in each piece. Mm. So I wonder if we could start out just by talking about this intention as you were writing these stories or essays, as they may be called.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm very conscious all the time. And I, you know, for me, teaching is so intimately connected with my writing.
Yeah.
And one thing I always remind students is that we ask race to bear more than it can bear.
Okay.
To do more work than it can actually do, which I mean to stand for everything. You know, so we think about Blackness and we forget about gender and sexuality, class, region, generations, you know, the generational changes and nuances and racial identity. And it's just, it's something that just is true. You know, it's not even, I write about it in the introduction and try to, and kind of putting out there something that I just live, you know. I live in a way that, and we all do, you know. In the same moment, there's like a split screen where race is primary, but also gender is primary. In fact, I've been thinking a lot, and I feel like this book is I'm seeing it as the first of a trilogy of books. I think committed the project of remembering is what I'm interested in over the next two books. And I want to write about women. I spent the early part of my writing life writing about my, you know, passion, Carl Van Vechten and Langston Hughes. And it was great and it was wonderful. But I ended up in conversations implicitly and explicitly about masculinity. And, you know, it's cool, it's great. But I'm just sort of now I'm really feel, because of the times and because of everything that's happening, I want to be involved in conversations that are about women.
Yeah, right. Okay. And then you have another book that's about friendships and race. Are most of those anecdotes and stories about women? Or I haven't read that one. So is it sort of equally men and women that you write mm-hmm. about as far as those friendships?
Well, that book is, I'm really proud of that book. It's a collection of essays that I solicited from writers, you know, around the country.
Oh, so that was your, yes. you were working as an editor to
That's
that
right,
book.
Exactly. Ah,
okay. Sorry.
But when, the reason why I really like that book is that, you know, when we say race in this country, it's always the default, you know, black v. white.
Yes.
And I think it's true for, you know, other racial groups, you know, Asian v. white.
Right.
And so we forget that there's not just that binary all the time.
Right, yeah.
And the book, I think, is frankly unique because it does, it tries to accommodate voices, interracial friendships, you know, outside of that binary of everything else and white. And so I'm proud of that. I think it represents more of the world today and how we live in this country, which is one of the reasons I wanted to put it together, you know. Because I think it's multivocal and available and applicable to more than just, you know, one or two experiences.
Yeah.
But there so that was my intention with that book, to move beyond that black-white divide, which is just sort of not true
right.
anymore and never has been, and to consider other kinds of experience, just so we can all be reminded that race is more complex in the way we often reduce it to in popular discourse.
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe we'll talk more about that later, too. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk, too, about the beginning of Black is the Body, in which you talk about having been the victim of an attack. You write that a bizarre act of violence set you free, and it concerns your having survived a stabbing in 1994. It was a random attack in a Connecticut coffee shop where 7 people were wounded, including yourself. And the story Scar Tissue is more specifically about this event, and I wondered if writing about it helped with the long-term emotional healing, and if you continue to write about it as time goes by. Does it continue to be something that you keep coming back to?
Yeah. I like that. You know, it's interesting. You said the word healing, and I think of it so much as it's about mastery.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's still, to me, I'm in a contest with it all the time. Who's in control here?
Yeah.
So I don't have a gentle relationship. I think it's maybe a life project to develop a more gentle relationship with that experience. But it certainly has shaped me in ways that I'm still uncovering.
Yeah.
So I set out to write, you know, I was sitting in a coffee shop with my friend Ann Fadiman, who wrote the wonderful book, When the Spirit Catches You, You Fall Down, which I heartily recommend.
Okay.
And we're sitting in another branch of coffee in New Haven. And I said, oh, Ann, I was stabbed in a coffee because that's just my way. And she said, well, you're going to write about this. And I said, oh, it was so
wow.
much part of my life that mm-hmm. it didn't actually speak to me as extraordinary. And Ann said, you know, not everybody gets stabbed. I think this is actually a story people would find interesting. But it took me a long time after that, and it was a friend of mine, actually, my dear friend, my colleague, Lisa Chanel, who asked me to give a lecture to the Honors College. And I think the topic was something about knowledge
okay.
and how we know things. And so I started to think, it was sort of came together, okay, it's time to write about this, and how do I know what happened? You know, that I could talk to it about with my friend and deliver this information to her. And she could just be completely, you know, it's like, sometimes I feel like there's a disconnect.
Right.
So I think that the essay was trying to bridge the gap.
Right.
Between my experience and how other people experience it and figure out what does this really mean. But I needed to pull back because the story is, I mean, it's really just a pretty sensational story. There's a lot of blood in it and violence. So it was a question was how to tell it
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
effectively. And that becomes like a writerly question.
It does. And actually, there's this moment, if you don't mind my interrupting you, there's this, mm-hmm. in describing the moment itself in the essay, you string together a series of words. I'm going to read them if it's okay. Suddenly, chaos, pandemonium, bedlam, topsy-turvy, madhouse, a holy mess, all hell broke loose. The room turned upside down, on its back, inside out, went crazy, flipped out, other words, other cliches. I just loved that you did that. And and I think sometimes when we are trying to write about a great moment of emotion, or in this case, violence and emotion, we do turn to cliche. And I loved that you named them. Mm-hmm. You're like, here's what it was like. And I know this is cliche, and these are the cliches to describe it. So that, as far as just like the craft of writing the moment, was really interesting
to
me.
I'm so glad. Well, you know, even, you know, there are cliches for a reason, you know? And when I was sitting, I remember that moment, you know, of course, I'll always remember it, sitting with another victim and thinking, oh, that is what white as a sheet looks like, you know? And again, it's just like that writer brain is just always at work, and probably just to protect you, you know, from what's happening, the kind of sheer absurdity and, you know, terrifying chaos of what's happening.
Madness.
Yeah, the madness of it. But I remember thinking, oh, there's a reason why this phrase exists. And I'm looking at this right now. So I wanted to, yes, address that. And again, yeah, the question of how to tell it and what, because cliches also, we all, it's part of our popular understanding and way we, you know, but as a writer, you have, of course, be very careful not to indulge in them too much.
Well, that's what I loved that you named it, that you said, you know, this is cliches, because you don't want to look like you didn't know you did that.
Right, right, sure. That's right, exactly, exactly.
But I'm interesting, it's interesting to me that you didn't write about that event until you were asked to do so, or until it occurred to you that this would work in a work setting.
Yeah.
Are you not a journaler?
Oh, I am.
You
I
are?
Am a journaler, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I think that, you know, in a way, it just felt too easy.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's one reason
like
why...
like the obvious thing to write about.
And, that's one reason why I wanted to put it at the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of reasons for that, but it just is like, you know, it's just not the kind of writer I am. I like to actually think of this as a quiet book. Mm-hmm. I mean, I care a lot about metaphor and how sentences work, and I could go on and on about the semicolon.
Right.
And that's the kind of... that's how I came up, you know, and those are the things that really preoccupy me, honestly. And so... It felt, I think that yeah, and I also, but I mean, I didn't know how to tell it.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to tell it in a way that was taking advantage of how dramatic it already is.
Yeah.
It just, the way my brain works, you know, just, I need to find the subtlety in order to tell it the way I needed to tell it.
Yeah. And I was interested also in how you brought in different time periods to talk about how it has affected you over time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It sounded like it happened maybe before you were married.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, you bring in subsequent events that take you to the hospital with your family to kind of like show how it's affected you over time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which was,
It still affected. I mean, it was just, I really was probably... 2 weeks after I turned in the final manuscript, and I was back in the hospital with another bout of adhesions. And so, you know, it really punctuates my life in ways that I am still battling with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was one more, if I can ask one more craft thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is later in the essay. You were talking about how you didn't move at a certain moment when you could have, and you said, why? I did not move because I did not want to excite this man. I did not move because I had to see what was going to happen next. I did not move because I was afraid. I did not move because I was free from fear, as many report feeling in the moments before death. I did not move because I knew that he would hurt me if I did. I did not move because I knew he would not kill me. I did not move because I didn't believe he had the knife I saw in front of me. I did not move because I did not know what to do. I just, that section I loved. And I loved the repetition of I did not move and the desire to understand this thing that was happening to you. And it felt like a prayer, that paragraph.
I like that so much. I love the way you read it too.
Oh, thank you. anyway, I don't know if you have anything to, do you remember writing the repetition?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's so interesting because the way you are speaking, I mean, it's about the rhythm of those sentences together.
Yeah.
And it's a risk, I think, as a writer, you take when you are doing something that's so obviously deliberate, you know, that's so, what you're doing is obvious, but it did, you know, those things were all happening at once, like within one sentence.
Right.
It was, you know, it would be too cluttered to put them all in one sentence. And you're right, the rhythm is there. But it's literally was this, you know, fill it in like a Mad Libs, you know. all of those things were true
right.
at the same time.
Right.
You know, that, and it was all happening within seconds, like maybe 2 seconds at the most.
Sure. And it would be misleading for me to indicate that this is how the essay sounds. That was one paragraph within a very well-crafted essay that has a whole lot of different parts to it, and that was one part.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so this this section, another thing that you write that still has to do with the same event. You recounted how a fellow graduate student at a party once asked if the man had, as she put it, hurt your lady parts, which was, you know, you found it amusing at the time. Mm. And you wrote, insofar as any story I have ever heard belongs in some way to me, my story belongs to her to recount as she pleases. I cannot dictate how she will use this story any more than I could control the knife that let flow this story in the first place. And I loved thinking about the provenance of story. And once we put it down on paper, who does it belong to? True. And who does it affect, and how do they use it? So how do you feel now that the collection's come out and a lot of your stories are in the public?
Right, very true. Well, it's very true that, you know, you spend all this time writing a book, and you are concerned about the shape of it. You're concerned about whether or not your metaphors are singing, whether or not, you know, you should use a semicolon or a period. And then suddenly it's in the world and people have responses to it. And it's a different, I'll know what to say about this in a year, you know, what this was like, but it's pretty extraordinary. And I'm thrilled about what I've been excited about and what I hoped for that has come true is, I think a lot about utility when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. It's very important to me. You know, I want the stories to be useful. And for me, the personal is a springboard, you know, to talk about some larger issues and, dare
Absolutely.
I say, the universal. Otherwise, I can't use it. You know, I can't. I mean, I want to know. I want to be. So people have talked about, use the word invitation. You know, a friend used it, a student used it, and I thought that is perfect. You know, I wanted. So what I've been excited by, people talking about the book and how they talk about their own stories.
Yeah.
And how they connect, and I just love it. I mean, I just think that is exactly what I hoped for, that it would be. You know, the book would be in a conversation with the reader. I'm somebody who's just always longing for intimacy. I'm always longing for, you know, I love the human connection.
Right.
And so the book, you know, you write it in isolation, but it obviously involves so many other people.
Right.
And I'm so glad that people are feeling they can enter into it and kind of make it their own. Mm-hmm. So it's a great thing. And it's, you just have to practice that, you know, I think detachment in that, you know, it you put it in the world and it does belong. I thought I was saying recently, you know, so many stories that I feel like have, when I would tell stories about who I am, how many of them, and maybe all of us, involve my parents, my grand. I mean, clearly right. They're in here. And I wasn't there, you know, but so the stories out there that we choose to describe us, to capture who we are, to explain who we are.
Right.
And I like the fact that the book is sort of part of that now for readers, you know, that's very exciting to me, that it seems to have some utility. I was at a friend's class at Columbia, and a young woman came after my class and said that she had shared with her mother on Earth, a story about adoption, and she's Asian American and her mother's white, and she said they cried and they had conversations they had never had before.
Oh, I love that.
And I said, okay. That's it. I mean, that was what the book was for, and
yes.
I'm now satisfied forever.
Yeah.
That it had that utility, it had that purpose, it served a purpose for you, and it enabled your mother and you to have a conversation between
right.
yourselves. I mean, that's what I dreamed of, you know, and that's why I do this.
Right, right. And that line is something that you use to describe to your daughters, who you are to them. You're their mother on Earth, and the birth mother passed away,
mm-hmm.
and she's their mother in heaven,
yeah.
I think is what you say.
That's right.
That was beautiful.
Mm, thank
yeah.
you.
This essay you wrote, the essay Teaching the N-Word,
mm-hmm.
and it's funny, I actually went looking online to see what is allowed on radio actually
mm-hmm.
about that word,
mm-hmm.
and one of the first things that came up was your essay Teaching the N-Word.
Oh, wow.
I thought that was pretty funny.
That's funny.
Anyway, I didn't
that
actually turn up answers about that, but
yeah.
The second full story or essay in the collection concerns a class that you were teaching in which you introduced the writings of Randall Kennedy
mm-hmm.
Around what I'm going to call the N-word. I'm just going to say that rather than naming it. Even if this weren't community radio, that's probably what I would be
Absolutely.
Comfortable with. But I found the story and my resulting thoughts on this so fascinating.
Mm.
And I Okay, so your students are sort of reflective of the area in which we live, which is a mostly white area. So I wonder if you can talk a bit about why you introduced this subject to your class.
Well, you know, it keeps coming up. I mean, if you teach, you know, if you teach African-American anything, the word comes up. And particularly, I guess, a certain time period. But I would venture to say it's pretty consistently true. You know, we're all grappling with it. And not just as a word, but as a container of a lot of things, you know, history, racism, you know, identity, and literally naming, and what names mean, what rhetorical violence is. So it came up in the course of teaching this class, African American Autobiography. You know, the classroom had 10 fantastic students, all white, not surprisingly. And although I think our demographics are a little bit better now.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. You know, actually, that is interesting. Ago. Oh, that's how long ago. Okay.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
I wasn't sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I had this class, and so it came up, and it just felt it was time to just push the books away and have a real conversation. You know, I wrote that essay because, you know, every so often, pretty regularly, you know, somebody white says it, and then they have to apologize, and then they have to, you know, do something in public mea culpa, and then they
Bill Maher,
right. And you know, there's so many ways of talking about it, and so many, and I just wanted, I'm sort of tired of that ritual, a public ritual. So it's exactly the kind of thing that I just don't want to hear anymore, because it doesn't change anything. I didn't want to get on a soapbox and give a lecture and then, you know, have, it just seemed pointless. Like, you're just wasting words because people clearly aren't, it's not entering into anything. It's not making any changes. So I wrote this essay out of that frustration.
Yes.
And I didn't want to give a lecture. You know, I give lectures in my classrooms and I love giving lectures, but, you know, and that's part of the linear work of teaching. You know, you want your students to get something at the end of that process. But on the page, I can be freer and I can ask questions. And the essay, literally, there are spaces between paragraphs as a deliberate and visual attempt to demonstrate my own refusal, I think, to tell a coherent like story about this, but also to give the reader space to enter into this.
Yeah.
Because I don't, you know, I have said before, you know, as my grandmother used to say, don't write a check with your mouth that your behind can't cash. So what that means is you can say whatever you want, but there are consequences to what you say. So be prepared to pay that price. Because when people say, should I say it, should I not? I mean, the obvious answer is, I mean, why would you?
Right.
What is your investment here? It is an expression of hatred and rhetorical violence. And of course, there are variations now, and it's very intriguing, and language is meant to change, and that is what it means to make culture, is to test boundaries.
Right.
And that's what young people should do, and that's what artists should do. But it doesn't change that, right? It doesn't change the history of the word, and we were all implicated by that. So, I don't see the point. The word is so provocative, and, you know, when I give talks, even on, you know, Carl Van Vechten, you know, the word is very heavily associated with his career.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in an audience, and particularly if there are older black people there or younger black, you know, why would I say this? To what end?
Right.
If it's going to, you know, these sounds, they're inside of us.
Right.
And there's no reason why I would deliberately hurt someone.
Right.
To say a word? You know, what's the point? So I have certainly, it was a delicate project. And when I had to read the audio version for this book, I mean, my goodness, we had to take many breaks. I hadn't anticipated reading it aloud, although I have done that before. But honestly, I don't know that I would do it. I don't know that I'm eager to do it again, to read it aloud. It's just maybe I'm at a different point in my life. And it just, you know, I no longer, I it's been said, you know?
Yeah. I liked reading that essay and just sort of letting it make me think again, you know? I mean, I think to some extent, the fact that certain segments of the population won't say it because that is not acceptable, not allowed, that means we get to seal it up and put it away and not really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing changes without thinking about it.
That's very true.
Right? So I liked reading
I'm so glad.
The essay.
Yeah, I'm so glad.
That's
cool.
Let's see. Now, you are married to another faculty member at UVM, and he is white, and you write about that. I loved reading about your family reunion, and also you kind of weave through that, your family meeting him. I don't think it was at that event that they first met him. Was it?
My extended family had not met him, but okay. My parents had met him several times.
Your parents knew him, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, you talk about how, you know, he bonded with your mom over cooking and bonded with your aunts over eating their food, mm-hmm. you know, and just like becoming one of them. So, and then you talk about how he was driving your father's car at your father's invitation, but he didn't do it the way your father would have. I liked that. I had such respect for your husband when I was reading about his interactions with your father, because that's a hard role to step into.
Oh, yeah.
And it must have been pretty fraught, mm-hmm. you know, with tension mm-hmm. over what it was going to be. So anyway, let's see. You and your husband talk a lot about race, and you write, "We like racial difference, to experience it and then discuss it. There are interracial relationships in which each party claims not to see racial difference. I don't understand those couples and consider their relationships fundamentally humorless." So mm-hmm. I wondered if we could talk about that a little bit. I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I haven't heard that recently. I used to hear it a lot. I don't know. I mean, if I'm just not talking to new people in interracial relationships, but I used to hear it a lot. Maybe when I was first starting out with John, people saying, "Well, you know, I don't talk about race." And I thought, really? Because it's so interesting. You know, race is interesting to me. I mean, I write about it.
Right.
Because it fascinates me.
Right.
Racial difference. And my racial identity is so important to me. For John, I think, you know, I know that he would say that, you know, his Italianness is really central. But also class, his identity as someone who grew up very proudly working class.
Right.
Is something that is absolutely central to how he thinks of himself. But, you know, John and I both... We're story people.
Sure.
And we're both interested in, you know, identity and sort of who we are in the world. And I think both of us enjoy our relationship insofar as it allows us to think so much about who we each are respective to each other.
Right.
You know, so it's not so much about, it's always, of course, you work together, you're together in a marriage, but you're always working out your differences, aren't you?
Sure.
And yeah. So... that is tends to be one of them, but it's not the most. And I'm always, you know, it's fascinating because I mean, I think it shouldn't be surprising. I don't think about it very often.
Right.
You know, I mean, we're just trying to.
And you probably did at first.
I did at first. You know, you're choosing your mate.
Yes.
And you're thinking about what it will mean.
Right.
And I definitely did. But I think for me, you know, it was so much, yeah, definitely about with my father, just thinking about how much our relationship was, as you say, fraught.
Yeah.
Or you said, use that word. And that tension you have, I think that kind of specific kind of father-daughter dynamic, wanting to please him and wanting to annoy him at the same time, right. You know, and that came about as a kind of frame for choosing boyfriends for a long time. But as I say in the essay, John was somebody we could kind of agree on. I mean, you know, he was someone who could fit into my family and beyond race. He was somebody who understood the rhythms of my family life. And that's still really important to me. I think we choose, you know, our partners for different reasons. And I said recently, you know, interracial or inter anything is not for everyone.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are people who really, for whom it is important to marry someone from the same X, Y, or Z.
Right, yeah.
Because it is about continuing the X, Y, or Z, the tradition, religious background,
or comfort level of what you're used to.
Right, you know. Yeah. But for us, I think, in some ways, the tension of difference is exciting for us.
Well, when I read that quote that I just read, it made me think, too, that in a way, that's something else that race, you know, kind of like... puts on you, you know, like, because certainly, like, my husband and I have different religious backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds. He's from a city, I'm from more of a small town. He's older than I am. So that means we come from different musical backgrounds and political times.
Right.
And it's like, that's great to talk about all that stuff. So it's too bad that people maybe wouldn't talk about the really obvious issues of race. I don't know.
That's true.
Let's see. You just mentioned we were just talking about your dad, and later on we're going to talk about the Write the Book prompt that you brought in today, which is a great one. Mm. And I do not in any way mean to imply that your father is a villain, right? Mm-hmm. He's not. Yeah. But I loved in this book how he is presented from a sort of perspective of maybe the the opinion you had or held when you were younger, mm-hmm. a sort of intimidating figure. Mm-hmm. But there are times later in the book where you give him a break, you mm-hmm. know, and you kind of like write about things that he did that gave me great respect for him mm-hmm. and made me like him better.
Yeah.
So anyway, when we talk about the prompt later, we can talk about those okay. kinds of differences.
Sure.
Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I like to think that, you know, people change in this book.
Yeah.
You know, and I like to think I tell on myself too, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was, I can't remember the writer, she wrote Cherry, and I've forgotten her name, Mary Carr.
Mary Carr, right.
She says, you know, in her writing about other people, you know, you have to telling yourself too.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to read, you know,
perfect
anything
yeah.
where, oh, I'm the innocent person and everyone else is terrible. But, and it's certainly not true. You know, my dad, our relationship changed over time.
Yeah.
And of course, now I get older. Lo and behold, I am, you know, I, Harold Bernard, c'est moi, you know? So, I mean, I, of course, you know, it's a cliche too, you know, our parents and, or certainly feel I have a lot more understanding.
Yeah.
As I raised daughters that were a lot like me,
yeah.
very spirited. So yeah, I like to think that there's room in that book for that.
Yeah, and the other thing that you don't do in the book, you don't just sort of like pass yourself off as the expert in race. You know, there are moments in the book where you say, I make mistakes on this stuff too. I didn't know what I was doing in this particular moment or
yes.
what I was saying. You know, and that's great. You know,
yeah.
it's like nobody wants anybody to be... you know, to present themselves as perfect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I have, you know, I think you have to, and I think teaching, I like to think that because I have been given the gift of compassion mm-hmm. and forgiveness, how can I proceed in the world in any other way?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have, as a student, you know, said dumb things and been corrected gently
mm-hmm.
and been enlightened. So, it is truly the model that I use in the classroom. I think it's the only interesting way to live, to open the doors.
Right.
As opposed to keeping them closed and keeping people out.
Right.
You know,
right.
it's much more, I mean, there are some souls that can't be saved. But in general, I think people are trying to do the right thing and
yeah.
trying to learn. So can't you give people a break? I mean, I realize in some ways that's, I'm speaking from a certain subject position, as we say in the academy. And so maybe I'm clearly privileged in many ways to be able to say that and to be able to move in that way.
Uh-huh.
But that's who I am and that's where I'm from and that's how I proceed. So it's just a way of being that I believe in.
Yeah, yeah. I want to just pause here and say that you are listening to WBTV LP Burlington, 99.3 FM. We're streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is an interview with Emily Bernard. If you're enjoying the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and help spread the word.
Mm-hmm.
So Emily, were there any stories you initially planned to include in the collection that ultimately didn't make the cut?
Yes, there were a couple. I wrote a couple of other essays about friendship, and I had one actually called Fired that actually played very well, and it was collected in Best African-American Essays. I forget what volume.
Oh, wow.
And I liked it, and I wrote it in one of those essays that sort of came out in a rush, and I liked it a lot, obviously enough to submit it, and it was published in the American Scholar, where I published most of my work. But in the end, I decided not to include it. I wrote it in when I was really just kind of out of the gate. As a writer in this way. And I didn't write it, I wrote it with some, not malice in my heart, but I didn't write it, my motivations were not pure.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, it's not wrong sometimes to write and it's vengefully. I remember this great essay by Katha Pollitt called Learning to Drive that was about being left by her partner. And it was so funny and it was so bitter. And sad, but it was full of bit. I mean, it was definitely that was the hammer she was using. That was the vehicle, and obviously very consciously. But so this essay was written in that place. And actually, it was someone wrote me a very lovely letter. It was a man wrote to an email, and he said, "I have to ask you, you know, respectfully, if you could choose the friendship or the essay, what would you choose?" And I took some time to think about it. And I said the essay. But again, that was a long time ago. And I wouldn't have the same answer now.
Yeah.
So.
Did you write back to him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I wrote him.
Yeah.
You know, and he was like, you know, we had a nice exchange about it. But
nice.
I thought to myself, and, you know, there's certainly you know, certainly, definitely writers who feel like it's a story all the way, hands down. And, you know, William Faulkner famously said, you know, a good piece of writing is worth a bunch of whatever dead grandmothers, like, run them over with your car. So, you know, I mean, I think when I was first out of the gate, I loved that romantic idea. But I think, you know, look, women, I've been thinking about this a lot. But and I teach about this in my African American woman writers class. But we live in community, and I certainly live in community, and I'm upheld by my community. I've made whole by my community, and I definitely know this more as I get older, and I don't feel as insecure or as what's this thing I'm doing now? Just sort of embattled.
Okay.
As a writer, like at first when I came out, it's like no one's gonna stop me.
Right. Okay.
You know, I've got to say my thing. And now I think, well, okay, it's not so I'm not so pressed about it anymore, and I can think more about the implications. But it took me a long time.
Yeah.
And I still am someone who just organically needs to test the line. I think about the kinds of stories that are mine, stories that are belong to other people. It's just something I'm destined to keep doing.
Right.
And maybe make mistakes here and there. But I don't think of the essay as a mistake, but it didn't fit in with the tone of the book.
Yeah.
And people have, again, thinking about utility, people tell me, I got a wonderful letter, actually. And it's about the breakup of a friendship, and I framed it around race. And the ultimate, you know, takeaway from that essay, I think, is that, you know, I talked about the end of that friendship as somehow being determined by race, but I only said that because out of my own shame, I think about the friendship ending, and it really wasn't about that. So I confess that in the essay. But I must say, one thing that's been great, I got an email from a man, and he was like, you know, I'm 80 years old, you know, World War II vet. This was some years ago. He said, you know, I lost my best friend of like 60 years, and my wife and I have been puzzling over what happened. He just stopped communicating with me. And he said, you know, it has caused me such shame, because he identified with the thing I said in the essay that, you know, there's no Hallmark card for a loss of a friendship.
Right.
You know, there's no way to do something in court where things get externalized and you can kind of have a satisfying break, a legal break. Not that it can ever is an easy cure either, but you know, something people feel often ashamed about, being dumped by a friend.
Right.
So it's why I wanted to tell it, and it was so thrilling and satisfying to me that this person, again, across time, across, we'd never meet in life, and for him it was his own story, and that was very wonderful to that my story kind of kept him company.
Yeah.
But in this book, I was trying to do something else.
That's it.
You know, yeah. And I feel like I'm in sort of and maybe I'll be in another place yet again, but the me who wrote that essay is, I certainly haven't changed, but I'm definitely asking more questions now what it means to write about other people, you know.
And it sounds like you would come at that story from a different place now, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And, that essay was probably the closest I've ever come to sort of presenting myself as a victim, although I did... I do tell myself in that essay too, but it was a deliberate choice. I did it with that kind of bitter humor.
Right.
But I don't feel, I'm just, these days I'm glad to be alive.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The world the way it is.
Yeah.
I'm not mad at anybody.
Right.
You know, I just, let's just please try to live and try to make peace in this world.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I'm about these days.
Great.
Peace.
That's great. Keeping an eye on the clock here. Let's see. I did want to talk about this. This may be one of my last questions for you, but you have two quotes from the piece called Skin that really stood out to me.
Mm.
I don't know how long ago you wrote this, but you wrote, "These days, what I encounter in the classroom is a generation afraid to say what they see."
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing that you write in that same one is, "It is dangerous to talk about racial difference these days. You might, God forbid, be called a racist, which is, in the eyes of some people, akin to being declared a murderer. So we resort to the seemingly safe terrain of colorblindness, which can be a kind of violence, an aggressive act of willful ignorance."
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked a little bit about some of this already, but I wonder if you can just address that, particularly in the classroom, and sort of how that makes you feel as a professor.
Well, let's see. Yeah, it's a murky territory. I mean, you know, it comes up. It always strikes me as absurd at some point in a classroom when I'm realizing, and I always try to, you know, I try to get to know my students, and I want to know what they're there for.
Right.
What are you here for? I hope they're here for something. I want them to be here for something beyond just because this was class was open and or something. Let's get into it. Mm-hmm. Let's try to do something, some life work in here. Mm-hmm. And it becomes, again, as I get older, and I'm say it again, the world the way it is, let's really do it. Let's really get in there and try to figure what's happening and make ourselves better, make the world better. And obviously, racism is just a virus, like a terrible pathology in our culture that is costing us every day in so many ways, not only bodies, but, you know, in our very intelligence as a species.
Yeah.
It just corrodes our humanity, right? So I feel like the classroom is where I can do some corrective work, if I may be so bold, but that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And so it means that we have to acknowledge the things that we fear and that we hope and that we are scared to say. And I try to create, you know, the kind of proverbial safe spaces. But they're not safe spaces, meaning that we are going to not say things. We're going to practice good citizenship, I tell my students. You know, there's so little of it out there. So we're going to hone those skills.
Right.
And that means that we have respectful disagreement. That means we say what we mean.
Mm-hmm.
And that we compose ourselves and, you know, kind of put away, again, victimhood for my white students. I tell them, okay, you don't want to be made to feel guilty for a second. I can't use your guilt. Nobody can. As Langston Hughes would say, it doesn't raise anybody's wages for you to feel guilty.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit of self-indulgence. We don't have time for that. So, you know, but we have to get past that, and we have to acknowledge that there is difference. What is it? It's changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things we experience that are not what they seem, right? Racial difference. But it has to be acknowledged. It has to be respected.
Right.
You know, as opposed to, I think, participating in some fantasy that there is no difference. Which, who does that serve?
Right.
Say there's no, because you're afraid to say it.
Yeah, the one of the examples was somebody was asking you about somebody else that he had seen you with, and he couldn't remember the person's mm-hmm. name. And so he starts describing the person, and he goes through this whole litany of description and clothing and height and does not mention that the person is black.
Right.
And you're like, was he black?
Yeah.
And the guy was just mortified. But that's just sad.
I know. And it was hard because I knew, you know, he was trying to be respectful of me.
Right.
And he was trying to, you know, be respectful of the world. And that was what he was doing. I had this great conversation with, I in this African-American autobiography class, I have asked, you know, African-American friends and acquaintances in the community, would you connect with my students? And it was something I was, you know, kind of doing. I'm going to try this because what I was basically asking them was to reveal themselves.
Right.
I've been overwhelmed with gratitude how many of my friends have said yes. And have found it very useful for themselves.
Yeah.
So I had a friend come to class, my friend Ruben Jackson, who's since moved to D.C.
Oh, okay.
And he came and he talked to my students about his experiences. And, you know, I mean, I'm very aware that a lot of these kids have never had this experience with a black adult before. They just haven't.
Yeah.
So he comes in and he introduces himself and he shares his stories and he's extremely generous with them. And I had one kid in the back, tall, blonde kid, who, you know, was just a college student just doing his thing. And there's a lot going on I knew inside from reading his papers. But he was definitely in a certain kind of posture and figuring out his own masculinity. And Ruben brought the class together. It was like a big, the walls were like hugging us. They stayed over in class. I just wanted to hold him as he was so vulnerable with them. And this kid said, you know, sometimes when I'm walking down the street, I will see an African-American person, and I want to smile, but I don't want them to feel that, you know, I'm looking at them or I'm staring at them, but I want to smile and acknowledge them. So I don't know what to do. Like, I will sort of look away. And Ruben said, it's okay to say hello. And it was a very important moment.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's how do I recognize difference? Am I disrespecting somebody by saying, hey, Nice to see you. Yeah. You know, or is that, you know, I noticed that there's a black person in this place where there are no black people, and I'm happy to see you. But is that somehow making you feel, you know, sort of hyper visible? And it was, again, it was a precious conversation to have.
Yeah, I didn't. That's not what I was expecting you to say. I thought you were going to say the kid said something sort of inappropriate or.
No.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that, you know, it was Ruben's generosity again. But it costs.
Yeah.
You know, so I would ask Ruben the next year and he would say, okay, you know, I need to refuel. So then I would say, okay, I'll hit you again next year and then ask. Because it's a lot to give, but, you know, we all have to do it at some point or another. And, you know, and it takes kind of a vulnerability on both sides to say, here is really where I don't know what to do.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
And I'm really trying to do right and to make the world better. So help me with that.
Right. Okay, great. We are coming down on our time. I do have a couple more things I was going to ask you. What books have you read lately that you might tell readers about?
Well, I've read in a book that I'm loving, and I'm kind of very slowly, you know, rationing the pages. My editor sent me this book right before I went on this leg of the book tour. It's called Daily Rituals, Women at Work, written by Mason Curry, who, you know, very appropriately in his introduction talks about how, you know, says, I am a man doing this book. He did a book, I think, before this book, just Daily Rituals, Writers at Work.
And
he was lamenting. He said this book is a corrective because there were only, like, I think it's like 17% of those writers were men.
Oh,
women.
Wow.
But I've loved this book, 13 Artists on How They Paint, Write, Perform, Direct, Choreograph, Design, Sculpt, Compose, Dance, etc. And it's just been keeping me company.
That's one. Is it out now?
It is out and published by Knopf. And just these wonderful biographies, vignettes of writers talking about how they work. And, you know, as I'm on the road and trying to remember, I'm away from my children, I'm away from my home, there's laundry to be done, you know,
right.
There are teachers to be met with, and I'm just needing to remember why I'm doing this.
Yes.
And what my, remember that it's okay to be a woman and be, have passions and be ambitious and feel like I'm trying to do something in this world. So
right.
This book has been so important to me, and it's just so incredibly readable.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. And are you working on anything new?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you are. Are you talking about it?
Yeah, I've got two projects that I think are, I'm writing a piece for Megan O'Rourke, who's taking over at the Yale Review. She and I are discussing, I'm writing a piece about women and writing and work and ambition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have my class, African American Women Writers. I taught two great sections, so it's sort of anchored in another classroom, anchored in that situation of teaching students when Me Too was dropping and how exciting it was to be teaching women's literature, because we watched how the literature was at work.
Right.
And they would talk about utility. We were talking about the choices our characters were making, whether or not they had the freedom to make choices or whether or not the choices had been made for them. And the kids were coming in and they were just making changes in their own lives. And it was just like this, you know, the kids snapped today. They were just constantly. So I'm sort of anchoring in that class, but thinking about what it means to be an ambitious woman, mm-hmm. and the cost. There's mm-hmm. always a cost.
Yeah.
And to be a mother, you know, and how we do that. So it's a personal essay. And then I'm also writing a piece for Upper Magazine about my father, my complicated father. And again, how I am understanding him, I think, more and more, and also how he is a mystery. And he was, I don't want to open up a new door, but he, you know, he was an interesting person who had a private life that I didn't really know about. So I'm writing about that and my becoming acquainted with that and thinking what it means for me, you know, as I get older, to come to grips and understand who he was in our relationship.
Oh, okay.
So these two things, I think, are working in tandem.
Okay. Do you have new resources of information for knowing him better?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
So I am writing, and basically, I'm writing about a woman with whom he had a child, my half-brother.
Oh, wow.
And she and I have I never would have predicted this, but we have a relationship now as we're getting to know each other, because something I've had to just concede is that she knew my father in a way I never did.
Yeah.
I didn't know how I knew she existed, but I had no idea about their enduring relationship. So I'm trying to figure that out. And, and it's just, you know, so that's just the story I'm needing to unravel in so many ways, you know, just a story about who I am, and she had so much impact on my growing up, as my husband said, probably more than as many, more only rival to your parents, you know. So I'm trying to. So we're figuring out our relationship with each other now, carrying the memory of my dad, and I'm learning about my dad through her.
Wow.
So what that means, it's bringing up a lot of emotions that I've never experienced before, which is always really exciting as a writer. Like, oh, this is new. I'm feeling, and how do I capture this? What does it mean? But I'm also, I'm working on that book. I'm also working on a book about women. And I like to think that I'm at the top of this trilogy, this project of remembering. So there's this book, and my next book, I'm thinking about 13 biographical stories about women in a variety of professions. You know, we love the story in this country, the rags to riches story. I had nothing and now I'm a wild success. I always tell my students, like, what does it mean that about our values as a culture that we celebrate someone like Bill Gates? Like, I didn't even finish high school and now I'm, you know, it says a lot about us.
Right.
That's the story but what about the people, and particularly women who made choices, and maybe it didn't end up that you became a CEO and were leaning in. Maybe you leaned halfway in and, you know, there was so much pushback. Or a central essay I'm thinking about is, when I'm looking for a woman who maybe filed charges before Title IX,
right?
Maybe it didn't work out. Maybe careers didn't topple.
Yeah.
You know, and Ronan Farrow wasn't interested in your story.
Yeah.
You know, God bless Ronan Farrow, but you know what I'm talking about.
Right, right.
Maybe you were black and poor, or black and just, you know, living a life where at a moment when there was just no pulpit for you, as Nanny says in Their Eyes Watching God. I want to hear those stories.
Yeah.
What are those choices?
Right.
They have a lot to teach us.
Those sound like wonderful projects.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, those sound great. Yeah.
Do my best.
That's the hardest thing about when I ask people what they're working on now. It's like, well, I would like to read that now.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you for the prompt, or I can just read it. You did send it to me, so
okay,
I can just read it at the end. Yes. Right. So my last question for you, as I read Black is the Body, I felt this an admiration for the way, and you've mentioned this a little bit before, and you even used a word that I put in my question. You just did such a good job of mixing personal story, cultural story, universal story. Mm. And it's your book, but it became my book, sort of like what we talked about earlier. So, you know, I don't know. Do you have advice for writers who strive to blend personal narrative into story that carries meaning just beyond, you know, the anecdote, just beyond the sensational, as you sort of like pointed out that the first story was a little unusual for what you are most comfortable writing. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that a book that a lot of nonfiction writers, and maybe fiction writers too, is Vivian Gornick's The Situation and the Story, which I referenced in there early.
Yeah.
That's a really good, that's a really excellent guidebook.
Okay.
And how to think about how nonfiction works and why it works.
Right.
And she tells a whole story in the beginning about what came to her, what illuminated for her that her whole theory about nonfiction writing. But I always feel, you know, follow the story.
Yeah.
And here, listen to what the story is telling you. I think it was Grace Paley, another writer, said, we start with what's bothering us.
Yeah.
Something is bothering you. It's nagging at you. You know, what are those images? What are the conversations? What is that, the kind of glint of, you know, sunlight that just got in your craw?
Yeah.
You know, if you follow that, there's a reward in that.
Yeah. You know what bothers me? I never interviewed Grace Paley.
Oh, well. That bothers me, too.
That bothers me. Yeah. That's great advice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Before you go, do you want to share your website so that people can find you?
Sure, please do. Please find me at www.emilyrenard.com.
Okay.
And also find me on Instagram.
Okay.
At MMB, and that's EMEM_BEE.
Okay.
And also at Bernard Emily. I think I'm pretty good at Instagram. I'm not great at Twitter.
And is that Bernard Emily is your Twitter?
I think it's just Emily Bernard is my Twitter.
Okay. All right.
I don't have anything cute for Twitter, but I mean, I post things about, you know, when I'm doing stuff, but Instagram is where I try to get cute.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to put on a little bit of music while I say goodbye to Emily. Then I'm going to come back with the Write the Book prompt. And then we have an interview with Diane Setterfield, whose new book is Once Upon a River. Here we go. And thank you so much, Emily, for having been my guest.
It's really been a lot of fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Welcome back to Write the Book. We just wrapped up a wonderful conversation with Vermont author Emily Bernard. And she generously offered a writing prompt for me to use this week, and I'm going to share that with you now. This is it in her words. I tell my creative writing students that the best villains are born in ambivalence. A good rule of thumb is to let the reader love a villain first before you condemn them. If a character is wholly loathsome, we readers might ask why you are asking us to spend so much time with them, or why you allowed them inside in the first place. For this writing prompt, choose someone who treated you unkindly from your past or your present, and write about them, focusing on the one thing, a skill, quirk, personality trait, etc., that makes them lovable. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. As soon as I read this, I knew exactly who I was going to write about. I'm sure you all did too. Okay, so please make a note. As of April 1st, Write the Book will be moving to a single hour, airing each week at 4 o'clock on Mondays. This is not an April Fool's joke. Every Monday at 4 o'clock, Write the Book will be on for 1 hour. So that's changing as of April 1st. If you are interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, please let them know that archived episodes are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please comment about it, rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, write some comments on the Podbean website. Just help get the word out so people can hear the show. Today, you heard interviews with Emily Bernard. Her new book is Black is the Body. And then also Diane Setterfield, whose new book is Once Upon a River. So if you liked either of those interviews or have comments about things that you heard, I would love to hear from you. Next week, my guests will be Amy Rose Capetta and Corey McCarthy will be speaking together in 1 hour. They are Vermont-based co-authors of the new book Once and Future, which will be published next week by Jimmy Patterson Books. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. The Vault is up next. Thanks so much for listening.